This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Dennis Dale McClain. He's the last pitcher in the major leagues to win 30 games in one season. He did it in 1968, 45 years ago Saturday, September 14th, 1968, as Detroit beat Oakland 5-4. Remember the old game of the week with Kurt Gowdy? That was a game of the week. We'll talk with Denny McClain about then and now. Also on the show, David Mark from Politics. He will comment on what's happening in our world, particularly the crisis in Syria, and President Obama's moves, and how it affects the elections of 2014. And a big one slated right here in Louisiana as U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu seeks a fourth term against the hard challenge of Congressman Bill Cassidy. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your calling numbers 297-5633 locally, outside our area 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with Denny McClain, the last pitcher to win 30 games in a major league season. It was 45 years ago this Saturday, on a Saturday, September 14th, 1968. The Detroit Tigers face the Oakland A's on the old Game of the Week. Denny McClain, good morning.
Good morning, Jimmy. How are you, bud?
I'm doing well. Good to hear your voice, and I'm sure you remember 45 years ago pretty vividly.
Well, you know what? It was such a blur at the time. I will tell you this. It was a great day. It was a great weekend, and it's an event that I'll never forget, obviously.
As I recall, that was not one of your best outings of the year. You gave up 4 runs. You did strike out 10, but the Tigers had to rally in the bottom of the ninth to get you the victory.
Well, that's what we did the best. We rallied. We were never out of a game ever when we played that year, so it was, it wasn't anything unusual, and it wasn't anything that someone didn't expect, in a sense. I've always said it was the best baseball team for 2 years in a row, 67 and 68, I'd ever seen. The only problem we had in 67, I was out for an entire month, and that's the only reason we lost the pennant, I think, in 67. But the bottom line simply was they were the best. When you have Norm Cash at first, you got Bill Freehand catching, you had Dickie McAuliffe at shortstop, or second base, Kaline, Horton, Gates Brown, Jimmy Northup, and Mickey Stanley. I mean, that's quite a team.
It was quite a team. And as you recall, in 67, the pennant went to the last day of the season. The Red Sox won. The Tigers lost. And you lost on the final day of the 67 season. I'm sure the 68 year must have been one of vindication for you.
Well, I hurt my foot in September of 67. That's what happened. I mean, I didn't pitch from late August in 67 until the last game of the season. And I could, to be honest with you, I could barely walk, much less pitch, and it was my left foot, the foot I had to land on. So it caused all of the, I suppose if it was the right foot where I pushed off, it may have been a little easier. But trying to land on a foot like that was, next to impossible. And although we almost won the ball game, I mean, I think we were ahead at one time in the game too. So, but it wasn't meant to be. And as a matter of fact, in that ball game, the last two outs of the game, Dick McAuliffe, who had not hit into a double play all year, his final bat in the 1967 season was a double play he hit into. So, that we were doomed, as they say, from the moment we started that game. But it was a great weekend series.
And people forget how young Denny McClain was and the kind of work that he was getting as far as the innings pitched. 24 years old, and in the regular season of 1968, at 24, you pitched 336 innings. And then you pitched 3 games in the World Series. You started the All-Star game. You were in spring training. So I'm sure over 400 innings pitched that year. That would be unthought of today.
Well, sure. It's a different game, as we all know today, and they take better care of them. They pay them a whole lot more money. It's like when people come up to me and ask me, "Well, would you trade the $25 million? Would you trade the $25 million a year that Verlander is going to make next year for the 31 wins?" I said, boy, what a dumb question. Give me the money. I mean, my God almighty. It's, you know, but that was the way it was back then. I mean, my entire career in 10 years, I only made $440,000. And I was relatively high paid at the time compared to some of the other guys. And I know guys who never got out of the 20s, played 10, 12, 13 years back then. And it's now the owners now they're paying for it in spades, as they say now, because some of these salaries are so far up and over the line. Yet on the other hand, if somebody's willing to pay the number, you know, they aren't out of line. So God bless them, because it only helps us and it helps the alumni to some degree. Although the current players really don't share anything with the alumni, but it's nice to see guys that do well, and we don't have to worry about them when they get out of the game.
Well, it was 79 years ago that Dizzy Dean won 30 games. In 1934, he won exactly 30. And since then, only one man has done it, Denny McLean. And since Denny won his 30 games in 1968, only Steve Carlton and Bob Welch have gotten close, if you will. They each won 27 games in respective seasons. But here's how it sounded. Ernie Harwell, the legendary Tiger broadcaster, was at the microphone Saturday afternoon, September 14, 1968. Here's a sampling of Ernie describing the atmosphere at Tiger Stadium.
Well, this is the big day for the maestro, Denny McLean. Saturday afternoon at Tiger Stadium, September the 14th, 1968, and Denny will be going for win number 15.
All right, that was 45 years ago. Ernie, of course, was a big part of the Tigers' history, Denny, and I'm sure you get goosebumps when you hear his voice.
Well, Ernie was a great man. He was a friend to everybody. He wasn't, you know, the problem with broadcasters today, they're all homers. And I say that, I don't say that disparagingly, but apparently that's the way they're paid. So, and I understand, an announcer locally with a team, you got to pull for your home team. I mean, Lord knows we do as fans and what have you. But on the other hand, when they go overboard and they try to enhance a guy's performance who's just made two errors and went 0 for 4, and they all of a sudden, I mean, that's what I find distasteful. But Ernie was never could be called a homer in the sense of a homer. He pulled for the team, but he pulled for it in his own way, and that's what the players respected him for so much, because nor would he take any cheap shots at anybody. He just was, he was Ernie. And he's one of the last. I guess the last guy we still have left is the guy with the Dodgers, Vin Scully. He may be the last of the old group. And so we're not going to have broadcasters like that. Today they may have better voices. They may know more about the game. They may know more about all of these crazy statistics, quality starts and whips and dips and poops and whatever the hell you want to call them. But, you know, the broadcasters from yesterday, they added a degree of knowledge and getting to know the players in a much more close manner, I think. I don't think announcers today have the relationship that we once did, because we traveled the same way, we were with us the same way, but we actually hung out together at night from time to time. So it was a different relationship.
And after you retired, you held many jobs, but one of your more accomplished, you were a broadcaster.
Yeah, I've done radio and TV for a long, long time now, and not only that, but we've done some other things, but the biggest thing is you know, I love doing the radio and TV. It's something that I've always enjoyed. You know, I see enough people in a week to in a month and a year to have some knowledge about everything, but never an expert at anything. And so it's one of those things. You know, you can listen and enjoy it, but God, don't take it to the bank.
Well, you're kind of an everyman, a kid from Chicago who follows the world, and you have a way with words. You were kind of like Muhammad Ali. You were as quick with your mouth as you were with your hands. And speaking of those hands, Kevin Gallagher and J.C. Kane, our producers, have come up with Denny McLean at the Hammond Organ. I guess this was probably circa 1969. Here's Denny, who, as you can hear, was an accomplished and still is an accomplished organist.
Thank you.
that one, Denny?
I remember them all, Jim.
The Girl from Ipanema with Dennis Dale McLean at the organ. You made pretty good money away from the ballpark, didn't you, at the organ?
Well, I was with Hammond and Pepsi for many, many years. And, you got to do something after you get something. And back then, managing in the minor leagues or coaching in the minor leagues, I mean, there was literally no money. So you really, if you had a family like I did, a wife and four children, it would be real tough to be traveling all year long making $20,000 a year. It was a great time. And the music thing provided us a pretty good living for a lot of years. And, of course, I still was doing a lot of club work up until the early 90s. So music, my dad said two things. One, if you can pitch, you'll make some money. And number two, if you can play the organ or piano, you will make a living for the rest of your life. And he was right.
Well, I would imagine, as foolish as it may sound to some, playing the organ probably helped you as a pitcher.
Well, I suppose. I mean, we've often talked about that. We've often thought about it because at one time in my life I had extremely strong hands, and I believe a lot of that was from two things. One, playing the piano and organ, and number two, I was a bowler. And I think probably out of the two, the thing that kept everything nimble and great was probably playing the keyboards, and then the second thing, the bowling. But the bowling gave me some great forearm strength in my pitching arm, and I think that had a lot to do as I started to mature at the age of 22, 23, because no kid at 18 or 19 or 20 in the big leagues has matured yet. I mean, things don't happen to you, you know, till you're 23, 4, 5, 6, whatever. And it's one of those things that as you reflect upon, you only wish you had done more of it at the time. And maybe the injuries don't occur. You never know.
Well, the Tigers, they got you to the major leagues in a hurry. And in 1966, when Denny was all of 22, he threw for 264 innings and won 20 games. You got a lot of work before 1968, and then, of course, 68 and 69, outrageous amounts of work for Denny McLean. But how much of an impact did that have on the fact that your arm went dead?
Well, what happened actually was the arm didn't go dead. It was my rotator cuff. I severed my rotator cuff, and we didn't have the Tommy John surgery back there in the late 60s. So the only surgery available was something that Billy Pierce from the Chicago White Sox years earlier had done, and he only lasted 1 year barely. And I wasn't going to go under a huge invasive operation for just a one in a million shot. And, of course, a few years later, that's when Tommy John surgery came in place. But, the arm was fine. It was the shoulder. And there was, you know, listen, in the last 4 or 5 years of my career, I had more than 120, 125 cortisone injections. And we now know there are all kinds of nasty things that stick around with that cortisone, the more shots you get. And I guess I've been told by a lot of doctors I've been lucky to live this long. So although recently I just lost 80 pounds, so I think I'm healthier today than I've been in about 25 years.
That's fantastic. How many cortisone shots did you receive in 68, do you recall?
I think it was 12 or 13.
Wow.
Wow. Because the injury started in 1966 in a game in Minnesota. I'll never forget. As a matter of fact, something you'd never see today, I was pitching in an extra inning game. I was pitching in the 10th or 11th inning against the Minnesota Twins and felt something pop in that bottom inning. And the good news is we won the ball game. The bad news is that the injury never went away, and cortisone all of a sudden entered my life, and it never left it.
Probably contributed to some health issues later on, though, heart issues, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, you hear all kinds of things related to cortisone. One of the things that slows down your system, whereby, you know, if you eat 1,500 calories a day, that's too many based upon what you've still got in your system or what it ever affected. How much of that is true, I don't know. You read about it, you see it, you're not quite sure because you see other guys who got multiple shots, lots of shots, and they're still skinny, lean, and mean. So, you know, the human body's a strange thing. It's different for everybody.
Denny McLean, the guest. We'll take a short break and return with him for a few more minutes. And 297-5633, your local number outside the area, 877-217-5757. Back with Denny McClain, 1968 MVP and Cy Young Award winner, and he won 30 games in that season. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and 31 wins in 1968 was the final total in the regular season for Denny McClain. He won his 30th game September 14th, Saturday afternoon, 1968, Tiger Stadium, Detroit, 5-4 over the Oakland A's. Nobody has come close since and unlikely to do so again. And, Denny, you have noted through the years that the game is now tailored for the hitters. The mound was lowered after the 68 season. Has that affected pitching?
Well, you know what? Maybe the mound is caught up to the player, the player is caught up to the mound. Because when we were raised as young kids and we got into the minor leagues, the mounds were 16-inch mounds, more or less. And we pitched on those our entire careers up until 1968 when they accused the pitchers of taking over the league, taking over baseball. And, I mean, what I always said was it was just the idea that more fathers were working with their kids in the 50s, 40s, late 40s, 50s after World War II. The families were coming together. We had more people in this country, more family time with each other. And therefore, the fathers worked a lot more with the kids. So I think what happened is they just got a lot more personal treatment. I don't think it had anything to do with the idea that the pitchers all of a sudden had gotten bigger and brighter. I mean, how could you be bigger and brighter and more astute with the game than a Bob Feller or Dizzy Dean or Lefty Grove and Cy Young? And I mean, that's what they were more or less saying. But because of that year, they certainly altered the game forever. They reduced the mound by 6 inches. And what they also did, because they wanted touchdowns, they didn't want runs anymore, they wanted touchdowns, they made the strike zone shorter. They made it less wide. And so everything that a pitcher... And keep one thing in mind, folks. Baseball has never done one thing for the pitchers since 68, only hurt them since 68. They've shortened the strike zone, you know, and they keep trying to do it and do it and do it. So my point just simply being that sooner or later, they're going to have to take into account all of these injuries that happen every year, as we know. Every day it seems like we get a menu of people, pitchers, who get hurt. Sooner or later, if they're going to do something to help the pitchers, they need to raise the mound. That'll give them a lot more leverage to take some pressure off those shoulders and elbows. And I hope they do it sooner than later, because the talent, we got a little bit of a talented crop right now in the big leagues with some of these ball clubs. It would be nice to see some of these guys be able to pitch for a long time.
Clay in Goodwood asks about steroids and whether you think Alex Rodriguez should be suspended for next season. What do you think?
You know, I'm upset with the idea that he has become the face for steroids. Let me point out one thing to everybody. There were 104 players just 5 or 6 years ago that were found to be dirty with all kinds of different varieties of steroids and drugs. Not one of them got suspended, except for one or two guys. None of them were exposed. Yet we go ahead and we really whack attack these 12 guys, including Alex, of course, who is, you know, the New York Yankees. You've got to be in New York. If you can do it in New York, you can do it anywhere. And the bottom line is he became, because of his attitude, I think, more than anything else. And yet, the times I've been around him, he's been a perfect gentleman with everybody. I mean, when he was in the minor leagues this year, God, he signed every autograph to ad nauseum, for God's sakes, in the minor league ballpark. So, I mean, he put on a different kind of side than what people were talking about. And this other thing that happened to him in Boston when that idiot with the Red Sox threw at him and got him, I mean, you know, listen, a baseball, folks, can kill people, as we all know. A baseball can ruin a career. There was a very famous hitter, one of the real good hitters with the Boston Red Sox years ago, a guy named Tony Canigliaro. And there was a guy named Jack...
Hamilton.
Oh gosh,
Jack Hamilton.
And Jack Hamilton, who was a fastball pitcher, big-time sinker pitcher, and threw the ball really hard. A fastball got away from him one night, and he hit Tony Canigliaro in the face, and Tony never played again. I mean, Tony never had an opportunity to be the player and died a short time, not months, but a few years later, a very young man. So that baseball can do a lot of damage, and that's what I really took exception with. Yeah, you can knock a guy down once in a while, and if you want to hit a guy, you hit him in the butt, you hit him in the backside, that's okay. I have no problem with that, although pitchers are not allowed to do that anymore. Our hitters are all prima donnas now in this world. You know, I just wish that a bunch of these guys who hit all these home runs today had played back then to find out what a Bob Gibson or a Don Drysdale or a Mickey Lolich or any pitcher that really had success back then would have done to you if you hit a home run and you stood at home plate to watch it go out of the park. I guarantee you, you would not come up the next time and be able to hit a home run. I promise you that. You'd be laying on your back. Because, man, if you stood on that, if you stood in that batter's box with Bob Gibson or Don Drysdale and watched the ball go out of the park, you might as well have taken yourself out of the lineup because something very bad was going to happen in an inning or two.
Did you ever throw at anybody?
Yeah, we all threw at guys. You know, I mean, the reason you throw at guys, and not necessarily to hit them, but to, you want to back them off the plate. You cannot give a hitter both corners. You can't give him inside and outside. You can't give him up and down. He can't he can't own the plate like they do today. So what you do is you pitch a guy a certain way, and you get him off the plate. Normally you try to back him off inside so you can at least get part of the plate, the outside part of the plate. And, you know, and if it required knocking a guy down or hitting him once in a while to get his attention, you know, you had to do what you had to do. I mean, that was the... It was just a different game. We were allowed to do so many more things. It's just like the quarterbacks in the NFL, and I fully appreciate what they're doing in the NFL. I mean, you can barely touch a quarterback today. So, you know, everything has changed. Has it all changed for the better? Has it changed to be more exciting? I guess the owners of the teams and the commissioners in the leagues believe that, and, you know, those are the only guys that are going to really make the final decision anyway.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone ever charge the mound against you?
Oh, yeah. I've had, you know, half a dozen of those, I mean, in my career. So about half of them I laughed at. I mean, I had, I'm trying to think who it was with Cleveland. It was a third baseman. I think it was Max Elvis. And what happened was Max had hit me pretty good the first two times up, and I threw him a curveball. And, I mean, you never knock a guy down with a curveball. You never try to hit a guy with a curveball, for God's sakes. And he got all mad and started running the mound. I said, my God, I threw you a curveball. What the hell is wrong with you? And, you know, that's the kind of stuff. And, you know, we used to talk to the players all the time back then. If I was pitching, I'd yell down to Boog Powell and Mantle, of course, and some of the other guys. We had some, you know, listen, we were very competitive, and I think when we played each other, we were on the edge of hate, especially if we were in a race. But on the other hand, we were relatively decent friends off the field.
Well, legend has it that that season of 1968, after you won the 30 games and win number 31 against the Yankees, you served up a ball to Mickey Mantle that was tailor-made for home run hitting. What happened then?
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you an email, and rather than tell the story, because I kind of keep that. It's a very cherished story, as you know, but it's in our book. And anybody listening to the show today, I'll give you an email, and Jimmy, I'm sure we'll give it to you later on in the hour too. And you just send your email. You send us an email to the email I'm going to give you, and we'll send you a free download of the book. Today, okay? We'll give you an email. The email is mu2denny@hotmail.com. That's M as in mother, U as in uniform, the number 2, the word Denny, D-E-N-N-Y, @hotmail.com. And if you send us an email, we will, in fact, send you a free download of the 355-page book with all the pictures and everything else in it, and including the Mickey Mantle story. Because the best part of the Mantle story is what happens, although the Mantle part itself was, I think, terrific because that was my idol growing up, but the best part of it is what happened to the next hitter, Joe Pepitone. That was probably one of the great climaxes of all time to a hitting session.
Well, Mickey Mantle, you played with some of the greats or against some of the greats, and, of course, yep. The Tigers were loaded with stars, too, and in those days there were only 10 teams in each league. So there were fewer jobs, and that's another reason why the talent may not be as dispersed as tightly as it was in 1968.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, the fewer teams you have, the better number of players. I mean, because the borderline guys aren't going to get to the big leagues with 20 teams, you know.
Right. Well, who was the toughest hitter you ever faced?
You know, it's such a tough question because when you had pretty good stuff, nobody was tough. When you didn't have good stuff, everybody, Gene Michael used to hit me when I didn't have good stuff, mm-hmm. like crazy. He was a 180 career hitter. And the one guy who got me for more home runs than anybody else was Boog Powell with the Baltimore Orioles. And the Booger now is a big multimillionaire selling barbecue. Excuse me one second.
Yes?
Orioles games. And a great guy. I talk to him from time to time. And that's the first thing he always tells me. Yeah, you know, I hit nine dingers off you. You remember that? You remember any of them? And I said, I remember a triple play that you hit into that I caught through the second and on to first base. He said, you don't remember any of the home runs. I said, Booger, I'm not talking about them. So he's a great guy, and he's a great ambassador for the game.
As I recall, though, you hit him and put him
out. By the way, I'm already at the computer here. I'm already getting downloads.
All right, well, that's good. mudenny@hotmail.com. mudenny@hotmail.com.
No, M-U-2.
M-U-2.
Right,
there you
the
go.
Number two, mudenny@hotmail.com.
Okay. Well, didn't you hit Boog Powell and put him out for a season?
Oh, yeah. I retired him for half a season. He had me so damn mad at one time. He was hitting, no matter what pitch I threw, he knocked out of the ballpark. He hit it off the wall, but he hit the ball hard. And I told him, I said, you do to me again this ball game like you've been doing to me. And I said, I will get even. And I wanted to knock him down, maybe hit him, but I didn't mean to break his finger so he couldn't play the rest of the year. But you know what? We won the pennant that year. It's okay.
Well, you know, last time you were on the show, you told that amazing story about the 67 season and the riots in Detroit and the doubleheader against the Yankees. And I got several people who responded saying, did they really play a doubleheader against the Yankees when the riot was going on a few blocks away?
Actually, it was the Cleveland Indians. Yes, we did play a doubleheader. And let me tell you the real quick story about it. It's simply this, that we didn't know about the riots the night before because it happened at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And we just came to the ballpark like everybody else was coming down to watch the ball game. And then what happened was we started seeing billowing smoke coming over the left field wall, which was about 8 or 10 blocks from the ballpark. And the chief of police came to the ballpark, talked to Jim Campbell, who was our president and general manager, and told Jim, listen, we've got full-scale riots going on here 10 or 12 blocks from now. And he said, the bottom line simply is, I'd like to get rid of all these people, cancel your doubleheader, we don't want anybody to get hurt. And Jim Campbell, being the astute businessman that he is, or was, said, chief, you're the police, I'm the ball player, and I'm the entertainment. You protect the people in the ballpark, you protect the ballpark, and we'll be fine. And he says, I'm not getting rid of 52,000 people today. They've all paid to get in here. We need the money. We want to be successful. And, Chief, I ask you to do the best you can. And we played a complete doubleheader.
With smoke billowing over the wall.
Smoke billowing over the wall the entire doubleheader, both games. And, of course, the following week, starting Monday, we were supposed to be home, too. And they canceled that week in Detroit. We played all of our games on the road.
Mm-hmm. The Tigers are pretty good this season.
Well, you know what? It's nothing's ever as good as it appears, and nothing's ever as bad as it appears. And right now, we've got a ball club that is going to win our division because, first of all, we're in the worst division baseball may have ever seen. When you talk about Cleveland, Minnesota, Kansas City, and Chicago, I mean, these four teams can't beat themselves. And the bottom line is, that's the division we play in. That's the division we monopolize, and that's the division we will win. But where do we go from there? Our pitching has got very inconsistent. Verlander's having a bad year. We did have one guy, Scherzer, who has picked it up. He's tried to win 20 now three times, and hopefully he'll get it this week. But, you know, I don't know. I cannot tell you what I think because when these guys get on a roll, this ball club gets on a roll, they score 8 or 9 runs a night. Now, will they do that in the playoffs when the better pitchers they have to face all the time? I suspect not, but they still got a pretty good ball club.
Verlander is 12-11. He starts tonight. You mentioned he has this enormous contract, long-term contract. Was that a smart move to sign a pitcher to that kind of a deal?
Well, they did, and I will say this, that you know, very few pitchers get better after the age of 30 or 31. I think they really rolled the dice because he takes such good care of himself. Now, taking care of yourself and your arm can be two different things, and I suspect what has happened to Justin is he's just found the first degree of getting older. By that, I mean the velocity is not as consistent. he needs now to learn how to pitch. You know, he's never had to learn how to pitch. He never had to learn, you know, when you're ahead of a hitter, what do you throw? How do you set a guy up and do this? Now I best think that he needs to find out how to pitch and to start looking at some of the old video and tape that he can find from the guys that really knew how to pitch. Because he's still a great talent. He's a great guy. You know, the bottom line is he just needs to draw the line in the sand and start doing some different things. And you know what? About every other game or every three or four games, he still goes out there and pitches a gem. But that's what happens. The older you get, the fewer great games you start to pitch.
Yeah, well, how good is Cabrera?
Well, I got news for you. He's as good as I've ever seen in my life with the current game. You know, one of the great things is he's on our team. The greatest thing is that he gets a hit against all this mediocre pitching. I take that word mediocre, poor pitching in our division. But I'm going to tell you, nobody hits the ball further and harder than he does. He loves the game. He's great for the fans. He does all the dog and pony stuff. And he just comes out every night to do his thing. He's a great ambassador, and I use that term a lot, but he's one of the better ones for the game right now.
Well, he won the Triple Crown last year,
yep.
And quite likely will win two-thirds of it this year.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's a great player, no doubt. But winning the Triple Crown was thought to be harder at one time than winning 30 games. But 30 games, I think, will be there for a long while before anybody does it.
I think unless they do something dramatically to change the game, that means they would have to pitch every fourth day. And with the money they pay these guys, that's never going to happen again. I mean, they think they have found the formula with this quality pitching formula that they have and what have you. I suggest to you that when you hit a million practice balls on the golf course, you become a better player. When you shoot 1,000 free throws a week, you become a better free throw player. When you throw 50 passes or 200 passes a day practicing, you become a better quarterback. Baseball is the only game where you don't throw more to get better. I mean, in fact, they throw less. And that's the thing that I don't understand, why we throw so much less today than we ever have. And a guy, and is it worth this 5- and 6-day man rotation for a guy to pitch, let's say, 12 years rather than pitch 6 good years where he's learning his craft all the time and he's sharper? Because no matter who you are, you're going to be sharper the more times you do it.
Well, once again, for Denny's last book, it's MU2Denny at hotmail.com for a free download. And
yeah, we got a whole bunch of them already.
That's wonderful. And you got another book coming, don't you?
We got two books coming out. We got one on the art of pitching, which was going to explain an awful lot about the pitching game itself. And then we've got a book called 31-6, which will be out probably in about 2 months, and it's called The Year. And with that book, it details all the 31 wins, who the heroes and the goats were, and how we won those games. Because the most dramatic thing is we came from behind that year about 45 times after the seventh inning to win a ball game. That's how good that club was. They could play big ball and they could play little ball. And this details how they did it. That was quite a team. I swear to you, folks, it's the best baseball team I ever saw for 2 years in a row.
There you go. Denny McClain, thanks very much, and congrats on 45 years ago this Saturday taking the mound and winning game number 30 against the Oakland A's, September 14, 1968.
Jimmy, thank you very much.
And we'll be back after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email at ingstershow@wrkf.org. Tomorrow, the LSU football Tigers take the field at Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge as 37-point favorites over mighty Kent State, the alma mater of one Nick Saban, by the way. Kent State lost by 19 points last week to Bowling Green. Well, LSU was pounding UAB 56-17, so the 8th-ranked Tigers should breeze tomorrow, but the big news has been off the field this week with Les Miles, the Tigers coach, getting the treatment he would rather not have from Sports Illustrated, which has been producing story after story over the last 4 days regarding LSU and Les Miles when he was at Oklahoma State as head football coach there for 4 years. He was coach there from 2001 to 2004, and the Sports Illustrated is alleging wrongdoing by Les Miles and his staff during that period from 2001 to 2004. And, of course, we will follow this earnestly on this program and on WRKF. And we'll get to David Mark from Politics in just a moment. But, J.C., let's give a listen to Les Miles earlier this week as he described his reaction to the expose by Sports Illustrated. Les Miles.
I revered my time at Stillwater. And the idea that somebody would characterize the program that was run there as anything but right and correct.
Les Miles, 28 and 21 in 4 years at Oklahoma State, 87 and 21 in 9 years at LSU. We'll talk about this and the outcome of the Kent State game come Monday on this program. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined by David Mark of Politics. That's Politix. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And David used to be with Politico and now is editor-in-chief of Politics. And your site gets millions of views? Is that correct?
Yeah, we get about more than a million hits per week, so, and it's part of another site, Topics. It has about 12.5 million users, so it goes out far and wide, and a lot of people like to discuss political issues of the day.
Well, what's the big topic right now?
The big issue remains Syria and whether the U.S. will take any action in Syria to stop the Assad regime from using chemical weapons, punish them for doing so in the past. There's a big conflict with Russia about who, if anybody, should be in charge leading the negotiations. So it's a big muddled issue. And President Obama is getting a lot of criticism both from the left and the right over his handling of this issue.
That he is, but thus far nothing has happened. And there is the prospect of some kind of an accord that would avert war and perhaps get rid of the chemical weapons. If that happens, does the momentum change for the president?
It possibly. The president could come out looking very strong out of this, like he knew all along that diplomacy had a chance. The administration also argues that just by putting the credible use of force on the table, it compelled the Assad regime to discuss its chemical weapons and be willing to give it up. That's debatable, but so far the administration has been able to stave off military action. And I think nobody's really anxious for that because we don't know who the Syrian rebels are. We don't know what kind of role Iran would play and whether it could open up terrorism. There's all kinds of issues that we have to be concerned about if military attacks go forward. So in a way, it may be the best outcome so far.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for David Mark of Politics. Now, how does this play with people who are in Congress, who, for the most part, will be running for re-election next year? Every member of the U.S. House and many U.S. senators, including Mary Landrieu, does the position they take on Syria potentially affect their political viability in 2014?
I tend to doubt it. Most voters do not cast their ballot on foreign affairs unless it's just overwhelming and it's like a 9/11 type situation where it did affect the 2002 midterm elections. But I would say that was the exception rather than the rule. Now, you could make the argument that this action by President Obama has made him even more unpopular in places like Louisiana, and it makes it easier to tie Senator Landrieu to President Obama. But I think that's a little abstract. I would be surprised if the Syria issue played a significant role on the campaign trail, particularly because the elections are still 13 months off plus, and hopefully the situation will be resolved by then.
David Mark, do you think that, let's say, Obamacare, will that be more of an issue in next year's elections than, say, Syria?
Absolutely. This is a bread and butter issue that affects most every American, old, young, employed, unemployed. Everybody's going to see their health insurance rates, if they have health insurance, affected. Even if not, they're still affected by it. And to me, it's pretty simple. If people see the cost of their medical care going down, they're going to like Obamacare more and be more supportive of Democratic candidates. If they see the health care costs rise, they're going to go for Republicans. And that's a simplification, but I think it has a lot of truth. It kind of dictates how things are going to go in 2014. So it just remains to be seen. There's a lot of unanswered questions about how these exchanges are going to work. Obamacare comes mostly online October 1st, so that's really just 2 weeks away or so. And so it's an open question right now. And if it doesn't work, I think we're going to see lawmakers like Senator Landrieu and others kind of run away from it. But if it does work, they're going to run to claim credit. That's usually how politicians are.
Well, Senator Landrieu voted in favor of it, and that I'm sure will be a major issue in 2014. Her U.S. Senate colleague from Louisiana, David Vitter, is sending out a release today. He's been on this for a few days now, saying, "I don't know anyone who thinks Congress and Washington bureaucrats deserve an exemption from the Obamacare train wreck, but believe it or not, that's exactly what I'm fighting right now in the U.S. Senate. Currently, unless we make a change, Washington will get a special exemption from Obamacare and a special subsidy that no other American gets. We need to say no to a Washington exemption," writes excuse me, Senator Vitter. Now, does he have a point?
Partially. There are some different rules for federal employees, but it's not like if you work for the federal government in Congress or any agency of the post office that you're just exempt from Obamacare. So it's an exaggeration, but he is tapping into a lot of deep-seated feeling about Obamacare that's just not popular. A lot of people just don't like it. And this is threatening to get very ugly with Senator Vitter. Democrats are and the Senate are not happy. They're threatening to bring up some incidents in his past that are rather unfavorable in his personal life. And so this had a chance to get awfully ugly awfully quickly.
Is that what you're hearing, that Democrats, who obviously would be the opponents of Senator Vitter, that they're going to bring up his prostitution allegations and revelations in response to him saying that they should all take Obamacare like the average citizens?
Indeed. My former colleagues and friends at Politico had a good story about this today, suggesting just that. It's actually Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, and some of his colleagues. That would be almost a nuclear option. That would be a big deal. That would turn this into a big personal fight. So we'll see where it all goes. But it's threatening to get awfully ugly. And, of course, there's no love lost between Senator Vitter and Senator Landrieu. They're known on Capitol Hill as a Senate delegation that's probably least likely to get along with each other. It seems to have improved somewhat in recent years, but they still don't care for each other too much.
But you follow Washington quite closely. You're telling me that it's not an open secret in Washington, in the Beltway, that Vitter and Landrieu despise one another.
Oh, absolutely not. I don't think even they go make much effort to try and paper it over. Sometimes they work on appropriations projects together and maybe of judges and the like. But for the most part, no, it's pretty much, they're pretty much not too happy with each other.
297-5633 for David Mark of Politics, formerly of Politico. And in Washington, what is the view of Louisiana's potential White House aspirant, Bobby Jindal, who is putting the gears in motion to run for president in a couple of, 3 years? What do you think in Washington?
I think it's possible. I think he certainly is a policy wonk. He's somebody who has a lot of national stature, and he's somebody who can make a forceful argument for conservative principles. Not sure he has the charisma to do it. I think it remains to be seen how much fundraising he can do, but certainly he remains a viable candidate.
David, who do you think are the most likely candidates, nominees for 2016 from the Democratic Party and the Republican Party?
I would say Chris Christie, certainly on the Republican side, the governor of New Jersey, Jeb Bush, potentially of Florida, although I'm somewhat skeptical, certainly on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton would have to be considered a leading candidate. Vice President Joe Biden, perhaps, but he would be certainly second tier. Basically, it remains, at least on the Republican side, a wide-open field, with Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side the leader at this point.
So we could have Hillary against Chris Christie. That would be an interesting battle.
That's right. It could be really interesting.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on the air with David Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, David. Concerning the vacant seat of Rodney Alexander, who do you see strong in that position taking it, and would they have any effect in Washington? Thank you.
Are you familiar with the resignation by Congressman Alexander here in Louisiana, David? He resigned.
I am indeed. I didn't quite hear the gist of the question.
He wants to know if you have a grasp of who is likely to be his successor.
I follow this a bit. There's a state senator who I think, a state lawmaker, who I think
I'm talking about Neil Reiser. Neil Reiser.
Yeah, that's it. Consider the leader. Thank you. It's a fairly safe Republican seat in northern Louisiana. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. So I don't think there'll be much contention, much of a fight over the seat for the party change. I think Republicans will hold on to it fairly easy. It is an interesting move, though, by Congressman Alexander, though, in that he's leaving in a position of authority. He actually is a subcommittee chairmanship, I think, of one of the spending panels, the appropriation panels. And he's kind of just saying, I'm done. I'm not up to the partisanship. It's also interesting that he's taking a job in the Jindal administration. Usually when members of Congress retire, it's to become a lobbyist and make a lot of money. So I give him credit that he's sticking with public service.
Well, as we've had C.B. Fergonston, who follows the Capitol here on this program, and he says that this move will enhance Congressman Alexander's pension. He used to be a state lawmaker, and perhaps he's doing it for altruistic reasons, but also perhaps he's doing it to help himself and his family, and that's generally what people do. But he's leaving in the middle of his term. And as you know, House terms are only 2 years. Richard Baker, former congressman here in Baton Rouge, did the same thing. You got to really want out bad or really have a very good offer, as Baker did, to leave in the middle of a two-year term.
Yeah, Baker left to become a lobbyist for the hedge fund industry, if I recall, or something to do with financial services. So clearly the money was beckoning there. I'm not a big fan of that. As you say, House terms are only 2 years, and it doesn't seem unreasonable to ask somebody to stick it out. Alexander probably should not have run again in the first place. But then again, it's one out of 435, and it's not going to make much difference if the seat is open for a short amount of time.
But it does cost the state of Louisiana some money to put on one and probably two elections to select his successor, and that is something that, you know, as much as lawmakers give lip service to minding the store when it comes to the budget, when it comes to their own district and their own personal well-being, quite often those thoughts are secondary to what's happening at home.
Oh, absolutely, and it's not really a good use of taxpayer money, and it would be much better if Representative Alexander just stuck it out till the end of the term, but it's a free country. You can't prevent him from doing it, so you just have to go along with it.
Well, David Mark, the editor-in-chief of Politics, what is your assessment of what you think will happen with the Syria crisis?
I think there will be some diplomatic resolution to it in the end. It's going to take a little while, but I think the challenge the president has is not making it look like Putin is driving the train here and being in charge, and that's a real big challenge.
Amazingly how the polls have been steadfastly showing the American people are against this by huge numbers, 2-1 at least. The Iraq debacle, I think, changed everything.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it really made Americans more inward-looking and less eager to engage in military action overseas, no matter how justified the cause might be, how humanitarian, to be blunt about it.
Well, President Obama, he was not in the Senate when the Iraq vote was taken, but he says he was against the intervention there, and now he's promoting intervention in Syria. Senator Landrieu voted in favor of Iraq and now is quite likely, if a vote comes, to vote against Syria. The roles have been reversed here in a lot of cases.
Yeah, there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around on both sides, in that a lot of Republicans were willing to give President George W. Bush leeway to be unitary executive are now coming back on have now been coming back on him. Now there's plenty of hypocrisy on the both sides, and it's just kind of amazing.
Well, David Mark of Politics, formerly of Politico, we thank you, and we look forward to another conversation soon.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend. And for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. We hope you have a good weekend, and we will be back Monday. And until then, we hope you'll keep listening to WRKF. Once again, we thank you for your support this week. And at any time during the year, your contributions are welcome at WRKF. And we'll be back in short order, so stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.